Party.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. A remarkable and unusual show opened last night at the Belk Theatre. A hit in London's West End and on Broadway, War Horse, tells an emotional story made all the more so, believe it or not, through the use of puppets. We meet the real stars of the show, the puppeteers, later in the program. But before we talk about four-legged propulsion, let's concentrate on two wheels. That's what Neil Bailey has been doing for years. He's an adventurer, writer, humanitarian, philanthropist, and road biker who hosts Neil Bailey Rides, which will be broadcast nationally on the Speed Channel, which calls Charlotte home. He's been taking other like-minded people with him to 45 countries around the world in the past 35 years, and recently returned from a grueling trip to Peru, which will be showcased on his show, which has been dubbed Reality TV with a Heart. Neil Bailey joins us in our Spirit Square studio along with his Emmy Award-winning producer, Linda Midgett. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here. And they've also brought along James Johnson, a Charlotte pastor fondly known as the Whiskey Priest. There's a story in that which I'll be asking about a little bit later on. Welcome to the program as well. Nice
Thank
to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
We're going to talk about this reality show, this new show that starts shortly on the Speed Channel, which, by the way, is up near our other studios at the university area, in a moment. But I want to talk about your riding around the world for 35 years or whatever I said it was. How did that start for you, Neil?
I started riding motorcycles when I was 15, and by the time I was 18, I was on the road. And actually, when I was really young, I used to hitchhike because I didn't have any money. And then when I finally figured out saving some money, I started buying motorcycles and buying old bikes and started riding.
What's the appeal?
I've just always been a traveler, just in my genes since I was a kid. Grew up in England, and grandfather was in India. In the 1900s, friends, family traveled. That was what we did.
But now you do it because you have a television show, and you've had several, I think, shows over the years.
Yeah, I had a travel show before this one, but it didn't have a philanthropic twist to it, and it wasn't sort of reality television. It was more documentary style.
But the TV paid for the travel then. How did you do this when you were 18 and you had no money?
Well, pretty simply, really. Just used to work two jobs, save my money, live cheap. As soon as you had a bit of money together, off you go. And by cutting out a lot of the stuff that you don't need, you can save a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And if you travel really tight and tough and hard to the bone, you can go a long way on a small amount of money.
I read a list of things to describe what you are and who you are and what you do. Among them, but I don't think I did read.
I think they missed Village Idiot, didn't they? That's going to be my future occupation.
They missed motorcycle journalist. That's a term I've never heard, so I'd like to get your definition of it. What is a motorcycle journalist?
Basically, I ride and review bikes or do interview people that are in the motorcycle world or, you know, do stories on factories or racing teams, just anything to do with motorcycles, really.
And you're also an adventure philanthropist.
Well, that's what somebody said. I guess that's when you ride motorcycles and raise money for kids. That's the new term.
When did all this come about? When did the philanthropy part of this equation come
about? Well, I think that's one of the key things to this story is, I mean, that really came in childhood. When we were kids growing up, we had some really good television programs. And you know, one of our main, you know, obviously in England, it went to every kid in England because, you know, we didn't have different states with different TV. And we had a show where every year we raised money for Africa. And at that time, there was a lot of famine, a lot of drought, and Ethiopia was the big focus. So we would do various things. I mean, just for instance, one year we had to collect old knives and forks and spoons. And they would melt them down and take the scrap metal and sell it. And they'd use that money to convert it to Land Rovers or grain, farming tools and implements. So, you know, as kids, we'd be running up and down the road with our little buggies knocking on every door saying, hey, you know, you got any old knives and forks? And we'd make a pile of them, and there were places you could drop them off where they would get transported. And then every week we would tune into the show to see how much money we'd raise or how many Land Rovers we'd bought. So I just think it's something that was ingrained in me. By the time I got out of school, we'd just been doing it naturally forever. I mean, it's just what we did. And, you know, our youth groups did that, our schools did that. And we were just very educated. There was a lot of need in the world. And, you know, funny, looking back on it, I mean, you know, my mother was a single mother and we were on welfare and we didn't have heat in the house. We walked to school. We didn't have a car. I mean, there's so many things that we didn't have, but you never thought of yourself having a hard time because we were always doing something for someone that was way worse off than us. So it started very early for me.
You're a TV producer, and Linda, it seems to me that there's a show in that. There was a show in that then. There's probably a show in that kind of thing now, using the same format.
Yeah, it's one of the things that really attracted me to Neil when I first came across him, this passion that he has for philanthropy. And one of the things that I think is, interesting about the younger generation, younger than myself, I think that they're more interested in that and have more of that global sort of awareness. And, you know, we hope that that's part of the appeal of this show.
Yeah, one of the most exciting things to me is I started talking in high schools, and I can't get out of there. They have to chase them back to school. And one high school I've talked to, the in Union County there, one time I was in there, they went away, and they all huddled together, and they formed their own committees and their own fundraising plans, and they put them all on for us and went and raised money for my foundation themselves. And it's just phenomenal. You know, you're just hairy, wrinkly old guy, and you probably think they're just going to look at me and think, well, he's not cool. And, you know, within half an hour, they're asking brilliant questions. It's really engaging. And when I leave there, I'm so fired up because I think this is the next generation.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, give these kids a menu option, something that's a bit healthier, you know, philanthropy and travel and adventure and interaction with the world. And they're going to take it because they want something like this. They're not jaded about it. They're not set. They're looking for what they want to do with their life.
You've worked for a number of networks and venues in various cities, and you've been a TV producer for several years now, Linda. This just didn't start with this
More
show.
More than several, but thank you, Mike.
Yeah. I didn't want to get too detailed.
I know.
How did the two of you find it? How did you find him, and how did you realize that what he was all about would be fodder for a new reality show? Because God knows what television needs is another reality show.
Yeah, I know.
Shopping with Kim Kardashian, and we saw both. I was having trouble with one of my Prada bags. Yes. Linda came and helped me.
She's actually Kim's daddy's baby. Okay. Baby daddy.
So how did you meet up?
I have to give credit to my husband, actually. My husband was at the chiropractor and read an article about Neil in a local magazine of some sort. I can't remember what it was now. And he came home and put it on my desk and said, I think that this is your next show. And I picked it up and I looked at the picture of Neil and started thumbing through the article. And it was about one of the trips that he had taken to Peru on the motorcycle to help a specific orphanage that Neil has formed a foundation for, Wellspring. And it just clicked with me. I don't know how to explain it. There was almost this sort of, I wouldn't say a cosmic moment or something, but it's like I looked at it and thought, yeah, this is something that I need to do.
And it could have been you've done documentaries before.
Yeah.
So it could have been a documentary. You could have documented his work there. You could have documented how he got there. You could have any number of things. But you chose to make it a reality show. Why?
You know, I have a lot of experience with reality. I used to work on an NBC daytime reality series called Starting Over. And that was a show about women that were trying to change their lives. And we won a couple of Emmys for it, and it was on for about 3 years as a syndicated show. And I actually enjoy the reality format when it is done like we did it on that show, which where there's more truth to it, so there's actually more reality. So it's not scripted reality. And I just saw the potential in this. You know, you've got a dramatic situation. You have natural stakes. You know, you're putting people in a new environment. You're going to see them be challenged themselves. And it just lent itself to it in a very true sense that I'm attracted to for this format. I kind of say that we're more of a hybrid between documentary and reality because it's really more verite.
And it's a short series. It's not a 39-week or 13-week series. It's a 3-week series.
Right. It's 3 1-hour episodes.
Yeah. You've been taking fellow writers on adventure trips on motorcycles around the world for, what did I say, 40 years, 35, 25 years, something like that. I can't remember what I said now. But you've been doing it a long time, and that's what you're doing in this show. You're taking a group of people with you to Peru and to this orphanage in Peru, and that's where James Johnson...
Yeah, sitting with one of them here,
that's
James
right.
Johnson.
You come into this. Did you ever...
And he's still talking to me. Do you notice that?
Well, just vaguely.
you're the Jeff Probst here. So did you ever think that you would be part of a reality television show?
Never, because I've never really paid too much attention to reality TV in general. It's just not my shtick. But because I've known Linda for 20 years, and really just we went to college together, just knew her tangentially, and then we got reconnected when my wife and I moved up to Charlotte from the Keys, and just became fast friends again. And so loved what she was doing because I think she's an amazing artist, a great storyteller. And and she knew that I was a motorcycle rider and just loved it. And, you know, I'm sort of a weird, crazy guy.
So I have to ask, because I said you are the whiskey priest.
Right.
I have to ask.
Yeah. So really, it comes from an old novel by Graham Greene, 1940s, The Power and the Glory.
Okay.
And in Graham Greene's novel, he kind of follows along a priest who's just – very unconventional. He sort of learns grace along the way. He's not the kind of guy that just has all the answers and has it all worked out. But you see in Green's words, this guy sort of working it out and finding grace along the way and becoming a conveyor of that same grace. So a good buddy of mine dubbed me the Whiskey Priest a number of years ago, even in seminary. And so I was always sort of on the fringes a little bit, and I'm all about the people actually on the fringes and kind of the black sheep, if you will. Mm. And so a lot of times folks will come to me who may not necessarily seek out traditional, you know, church venues and that sort of thing. So I've always just been kind of the wild whiskey priest.
They're like James Baker, Jim and Tammy's son, who have had had on this program several
times. Okay, because I channeled Jim Baker for a second. I thought, oh, man.
No. James Baker goes into bars and has little meetings with people in bars about religion.
Yeah.
You also have been riding motorcycles since you were nine.
Since I was nine,
Was it legal? I mean, come on. 73 years.
I mean, exactly. Yeah, since the early 30s. No, I mean, I was born and raised in the Bahamas. And and I'm eighth generation Bahamian. And so there, I mean, a lot goes that wouldn't go here. So I started riding motorcycles ever since I was a kid. You know, I was the youngest of five. So my older brother sort of took pleasure in putting me on things and having me go really fast and watching, you know, crazy things happen. And like me hitting stuff.
Uh-huh.
So that was fun for him, and it taught me how to bounce pretty early on. So we moved to the United States, still kept on with the motorcycles, and went to traffic court when I was 11 for doing about 60 on a sidewalk, because apparently you can't do that in this country.
No, you can't.
Yeah.
No.
So, you know, you live and learn. Yeah. It's interesting. but, yeah, just ridden motorcycles all my life and just loved it. So, yeah.
And on these trips that you have conducted, Neil, and on this trip to Peru that has been documented in this reality show, you've assembled a group of people of various varying degrees of experience in terms of traveling on motorcycles. Why do you do it that way as opposed to just getting people who are really like Hell's Angels in terms of their experience riding those kinds of bikes?
I just think you have a different experience. I mean, if you've got to prepare and train for it and you're challenged by it, really the concept is that I think if you take people right out of our Western existence and drop them in an orphanage, mm-hmm. they're not going to see the kids the same way. They're not going to see the dirt and the filth and the poverty the same way. They're going to be – it's going to repel them really quickly. And I think when you put them on a motorcycle, it's almost like I want to soften them up first. So I take them out and beat them up. And once they're all beaten up and in line, then I take them to the orphanage. And they're sort of ready – more ready to take the message because they're not seeing it as dirty and squalid or poor. They're much more likely to see the beauty in the kids when they're there because they've adjusted to the environment. When you first go there, it's a bit of shock to the system, the dirt, the smell, the noise, the poverty. But once you've ridden a motorcycle through it for 8 to 10 days, you're much more acclimatized to it. And I think it allows them to see the kids in a better way.
And the beating up actually for this trip began in this country because I'm told you took these folks to train at the TNT Motorsports Park, which is down in Chester, and the BMW Performance Center in Greer. I have 10 seconds. Why was that necessary to do before the trip?
Just to evaluate them and make sure the skills were where they needed to be. It's better to have a few minor incidents here than get really hurt in Peru.
We're going to come back and talk about this trip to Peru and about this orphanage that has been a pet project of Neil Bailey's for quite a while and about the reality series Neil Bailey Rides on the Speed Channel beginning Sunday, June 9th at 9. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and NC State University's Jenkins Professional Online MBA program, offering accelerated and flexible course plans to fit any schedule or location. Information at mba.ncsu.edu. And the law firm of Horak Tally, including wealth management and tax planning attorneys for individuals and businesses, advising clients on asset preservation, estate planning, and wealth building strategies. Horak Tally, attorneys who get things done. Well, South Africa has been through considerable turmoil in the last several decades, not the least of which was the discarding of apartheid and the political and social changes that resulted in. Well, in recent years, the U.S. and South Africa have begun to build a solid relationship, launching a strategic dialogue on many issues, including security and trade. And we talk about all of that and more with the ambassador from South Africa to the United States tomorrow on this program at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, conflict in Syria. Lebanon is hit by deadly rocket fire. The EU ends its ban on arms to rebels. And Senator John McCain makes a surprise visit. An update on the escalating crisis.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Neil Bailey and Linda Midget. Neil is the host. Linda Midget is the producer of Neil Bailey Rides, which has its premiere on the Speed Channel, which comes from Charlotte. Many people don't know this, but there's an incredible network of NASCAR network, essentially, up near the university area. And this show begins June 9th at 9. And James Johnson is one of the participants in Neil Bailey Rides. He and several others went with Neil to Peru to help out at an orphanage that Neil came upon several years ago and has kind of adopted as a charitable venture. In addition to the kind of training that the other riders did for this trip, you did something different, James. You went to a retreat at Belmont Abbey Monastery.
I did. I did a 24-hour retreat. At the Abbey there, which for me was just really important. I call it centering down. And what I mean by that is that, you know, you've got so many different things going on. You've got, you know, the physical preparation, the motorcycle preparation, there are details, there are lots of stuff happening. And for me, you know, to kind of go and have some quiet time and just sort of remember what it's all about, what my center is, and, you know, so that you're coming from a position of, like, peaceful strength, if I can put it that way. And I just had a great time with the monks. They gave me a relic.
So I'm told. What did they give you?
Well, you know, just a slight setup.
It was referred to in the literature as a third-class relic.
And I don't know anything.
What does that mean?
Right. So I didn't know anything about relics. And so when I spoke to Brother Edward, you know, he said, you know, James, we've got something for you. We've got a relic. And my first thought was, whoa, you know, it's going to be a fingernail or something like that. Like, wow, I don't want that. you know, but he came over with this thing in a plastic case that actually was a robe that touched the tomb of Father Solanus, who is going to be sainted pretty soon here. And apparently, you know, Father Solanus was an excellent choice to pray for you while you're doing dangerous things. So I was very, very grateful to it. And the monks as a whole, they're, you know, it's very different than I thought it would be. Mm-hmm. And so they've all said they're going to be watching the show. They were praying for us the whole time, which I thought was fantastic, you know. And
it's going to be a spinoff series, Monks on Bikes.
Yeah, exactly. You've got
to come back and talk about
Make a note of this. Belmont Abbey has cable. Let me know.
Exactly. That's what I said, too.
You've done a lot of writing over your since 9 years old, and so have you, Neil. So, and this was a dangerous trip. This was not a walk in the park. This was over some very tough territory, not the least of which, I'm told, were the city streets in certain areas of Peru, where the traffic is described as being nuts.
That's a good word.
Talk about that.
You know, it's not nuts. They have their own order.
Okay.
And you just have to get into it. What's nuts is if you don't quickly assimilate into it and understand what they're doing. If you bring your conceptual idea of what you're supposed to do, like, that's my right of way, he needs to yield, well, that's the end of it. No, he's going. And you've got to understand how they go. And our guide, Flavio, we have a 6'4" Peruvian guide called Flavio, and one of his greatest lines to Brandon, our truck driver, was, "Do not use your turn signals, amigo. It is a sign of weakness." And it's just beautiful because it really is. I mean, you just got to stick that thing in there. The throttle is your friend in Peru. Mm-hmm.
I have to disagree, though. It is nuts. I will say this from my perspective, which was in a car with the cameraman.
Nuts.
Yes. One of the other cast members, Dr. Laura, when we were
the
leaving.
The Dr. Laura?
Yes, the Dr.
The?
No,
Dr.
No,
Laura.
No.
Our Dr. Laura.
Our Dr. Laura. Dr. Laura Ella. She actually lives in Asheville. And we're leaving Lima. So, you know, it's our very first day of filming in Peru. The traffic is crazy. and she almost gets T-boned by this car. Mm. And I just stop breathing in the car momentarily because all I can think is I'm so glad I have liability insurance because this is going to be quite a trip. Mm. So,
and it was similar to like riding in the Bahamas too. If you've ridden any third world countries, mm-hmm. you can't have an American mindset. Stop signs don't necessarily mean stop. You know, red lights, all that kind of stuff. And if your car or motorcycle will fit in that particular space and it'll get you there faster, you go.
You do it. I was in Rome around the Colosseum. And
mm-hmm. So you understand.
It was a great big intersection with many, 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 many lanes. And we were in the left-hand lane going left. And somebody in the right-hand lane, the far right-hand lane, decided they wanted to make a left turn, and they beat us to it. It was very exciting. Now, yeah. I have one of my guilty pleasures is that I do watch Survivor. I have since the beginning. And I often wonder, is it as bad for the crew as it is for the people you're watching on camera? Because you have to go through the same territory, through the same experiences. You're up in the middle of the night. You're in the heat. You're in the cold. You're in the traffic. You have to, as the people you're following with the camera, and you've got a camera. So how difficult is it for the crew to do a show like this?
That's a great question. It is really hard, actually, on the crew. People who do this type of producing mm-hmm. are a special breed. You know, the hours are incredibly long. I guess I would include myself on that. You know, the cameramen are up at 5 a.m. to get the sunrise shots, and then they can film as late as, 11 o'clock at night. Mm-hmm. And, in a bigger budget, then maybe you have more crews so that people have more break times. We were not in that position. So
they were brilliant. They really were. They just worked their absolute whatnots off. And Linda was fabulous too. You know, it was really funny because we spent 3 years, beating our head against a wall to get this to happen. And suddenly we're in Peru and I can be riding a motorcycle and hosting a show and Linda can be producing it. We're like, oh my Lord, we're actually doing it now, after 3 years of meeting at the Greek restaurant discussing things.
And you don't, in a situation like that, it's not a scripted drama. So you don't necessarily know what you're going to shoot or how you're going to shoot it or what's going to happen when
you've got a loose idea. I mean, you're going from A to B every day and hopefully, are we allowed to talk about the sandstorm?
Oh, yeah.
So things happen. We were having a beautiful lunch on the ocean and I know Linda was thinking, well, this is great. The bikes are sort of in the sand. It's really beautiful. But,
I wasn't thinking this was great. It actually had been three hours of amazing footage. Well, I was thinking that's great B-roll, but that's
great,
about
but,
three.
But there's nothing's happening.
30-second montage. Yeah, there's no story happening.
But she's thinking we need some drama and she needs some action. Within 15 minutes, we're going through a sandstorm. People are upside down. Things are happening.
Oh, all hell broke loose. So, yeah. And I was so happy.
Talk to me about this orphanage, because you found this orphanage several years ago, and as a result of discovering it, you founded an organization called Wellspring International Outreach, which actually helps orphans around the world. But
Right now our focus is the kids in Peru, but we're going to expand that.
Talk to me about this orphanage in Peru. What grabbed you about this orphanage?
Reader's Digest story, in 1995, I made a trip from Guatemala to Peru. In those days, it was pretty wild and wild adventure. And I met this crazy Canadian priest up in the Andes. And we really became friends very quickly. And he told me his life story, which is really interesting because I wasn't a journalist at that time. And I went away. We used to write back and forth. In those days, people wrote letters. So we did a lot of correspondence. And he passed away, but I didn't find out about it until about 2004. Mm-hmm. And then over the next couple of years, I got introduced to his sister, and I realized one of the things that he had done in Peru was take care of Hogar. That was one of his big things. And his sister had been fundraising for Hogar forever. Hogar is the orphanage, Hogar Belén, the inn of Bethlehem in Moquegua. So when I realized that she was doing that, her and I put a medical mission together in 2008. We went down and started treating the kids. And that's how we started Wellspring International Outreach. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I was doing a travel television on Speed, which was great. I mean, we rode around. But it wasn't giving me enough. I just wanted more, so I think, well, let's put them together. Mm. And that's how we ended up.
Who are these kids? Where do they come from? How did they get there? Why are
they there? Great. They just drop them on the doorstep, They're missing limbs. Someone smacked them around the head. They got set fire to, They're just all the great stuff of life. I mean, there's nowhere to go. They're on a dumpster or they're in there.
So they've been abused as well as?
You don't know. I mean, no one can tell. I mean, some of them don't talk. I mean, some of them do. Some of them are really, really communicative and great, bright little kids. Others are missing limbs and, can't speak.
Neil mentioned a little while ago, James, getting you ready mm-hmm. for going into that situation, that he felt that if you say it again. You felt that if you prepared them for this by
softening them up,
they wouldn't be as shell shocked when they saw what they
saw. I wanted them to see the beauty of the kids, not the poverty that was around them and the heart.
So
they're beautiful kids.
When you rode in mm-hmm. for the first time and you saw this for the first time, what was your reaction?
It was very deeply moving. You know, again, I've had some experience in some of these sorts of things with my career, mm-hmm. Pastoral care and that sort of thing. But you know, anytime you see a child that has suffered for a long time and they're in very desperate, not quite squalor, but, you know, in places where you wouldn't imagine staying overnight, it is a deeply, deeply moving thing. And mm-hmm. so it's, you know, I said somewhere, you know, at first I was ashamed of myself, thinking of all the things that are important to me. And then you see these people who, despite the meager circumstances, have incredibly beautiful hearts, you know, that are very grateful, that are very loving. And it's this weird juxtaposition of feelings. And you think, wow, you know, and what is it that annoys me on a day-to-day basis? Look at these guys.
Yeah.
And so you reprioritize almost immediately. So very powerful. And I think it's deeply impactful.
How do you capture that for television?
The emotions are there. I mean, part of our job is to ask people the right questions and to pull out that experience. But, you know, some of our most powerful moments were just having the cameras on these guys when they weren't even aware of it because their facial expressions said so much.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Is the reason you're doing this show to get the word out about this orphanage? Is that why you wanted to do this particular
series? Yeah. It was absolutely out of complete frustration that I had gone down and done a medical mission, just beating my head against a wall to get the charity started and to do conventional fundraising, and just realizing I'd be 198 years old before I ever built another orphanage for them because I just wasn't raising enough money. Mm-hmm. And then realizing how much money the motorcycle manufacturers would spend to send me somewhere to write or talk about their products. And I said, well, you know, BMW will spend $12,000 buying me an airplane ticket to go to Africa so I can ride their bike and tell people about it. There's got to be some value to these words and these images. So let's make a television show. Just put these kids on TV. And especially, you know, My view of American television, I don't watch it. It's just I don't want to watch hemorrhoid commercials and a bunch of nut jobs, you know, eating worms and overacting, being themselves to get a Nike contract.
You're talking about Survivor.
Sorry about that. Yeah, there's no Nike contract at the end of our show. You actually have to get your wallet out and give some money. It's probably not a great thing.
You came to America 30 years ago from Britain with a one-way ticket and $200 in your pocket.
I did, yes.
And bought a bike and rode around the country, and you said America is a big freak show.
Actually, it's the biggest freak show on earth. Someone misquoted me on that.
And you couldn't leave it, and you now call Charlotte home. And I'm just curious, if this is a freak show in America, how did you decide to settle in such a conventional town?
My ex-wife moved here with my kids.
Okay.
And actually, it's one of the greatest things that ever happened to me. I love this city. It's a beautiful place to live, great people. Wouldn't have met Linda James.
Yeah.
Very happy to be here.
So this is the first season. It starts June the 9th on the Speed Channel. But
yes.
I think you're already planning a second season of this. Is that correct?
We are. We are looking at going to Africa somewhere.
Undisclosed location.
Undisclosed. I can't tell you. It's a big secret.
Right. So it starts June 9th at 9, Sundays at 9 for 3 weeks on the Speed Channel. I don't know what channel that is on the cable, but you can find it. It's there. Linda Midget is the executive producer of what is called Neil Bailey Rides. Neil Bailey is our guest. He's the host. And James Johnson was one of the participants in this ride. How many days were you out on the road?
I think we were 8 days, 1,700 miles in 8 days.
Wow.
Yeah, and the total trip was about 10 days, but that's a lot of mileage and again, through some wild stuff.
And I would love to invite our viewers to come to a launch party that having tomorrow night at the Noda Brewery, which is on North Davidson. It starts at 6:30, and at 7:45, we're having a time to meet Neil and James and the rest of the cast. And we're going to have dinner from the Tin Kitchen and King of Pops, and we'll also have a sneak preview of the show.
Okay. Thank you all for being here. Good luck with the show. Good luck with raising money for the orphanage. I appreciate your time this morning. Well, the show opened last night at the Belk Theater that is unusual and remarkable on many levels. It's also one of the most highly anticipated shows of this season in the Broadway series at the Belk. It is unusual because most of the road companies that play Charlotte bring with them musicals, and War Horse is not a musical. It's based on a novel and predates the Steven Spielberg movie, a major hit from London's West End telling the emotional story of a boy and his horse. The horse is drafted to fight in World War I. But how do you tell that story about a horse on a stage? The show's creators were struck by an idea, I think, bordering on genius. The horse and several other animals would be full-size puppets. But when they hit the stage, you forget within moments that they are puppets. And that is thanks in large part to the hard work and talent of our guests for the remainder of the hour. We've had many actors playing various characters on this show in the past. This, however, is a first. Christopher Mai controls the head.
Hi.
Hi. Harlan Bengel controls the heart.
Hello.
And Rob LaKey controls the hind.
Correct.
Lucky you.
Someone's got to do it.
Yeah, and collectively, they breathe life into a horse named Joey. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Welcome. Thank you.
Also with us by phone from South Africa is Craig Leo. He's an original member of the Warhorse Project. Oh, yeah, put your headphones on so you can hear him. He's an original member of the Warhorse Project and member of Handspring Puppet Company, the Cape Town, South Africa organization responsible for creating the puppets used in Warhorse. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you very much, Mike.
Nice to have you with us. First of all, Craig, for those who have both seen the play and perhaps the Steven Spielberg movie, I was also always told before I saw this last night that the play is infinitely better than the film, and that has proven to be more than accurate. Given the subject matter and what you have to accomplish to tell this story, it sounds impossible to pull it off on a stage. When it was decided to adapt this children's book into a play, at what point was it decided that they would bring your company, this puppet company, in to create these full-size puppets?
Well, it's quite a long long story, really. We had Tom Morris, who was the original one of the original directors of Warhorse, come to South Africa, and he saw a production that we did here called Tall Horse, which was about a giraffe that was presented to the king and the journey that it made through Africa before getting to Europe. And originally they wanted to they were looking at getting that production over to the UK. And at one point, Tom very wisely decided that, you know, why not tell another story? And he had received a book from, I believe it was his mother, by Michael Morpurgo, called War Horse. And what they did was they got the book. He got the book and then invited Basil and Adrian from Handspring over to start a very lengthy workshop process in which they tested various prototypes over a period, I think it was 2 years, to see whether the horse, in fact, would be able to stand on a stage and be a lead character that didn't speak. And that is pretty much how it all began.
Because you don't, you normally associate with puppets with children's entertainment. Oh, we have an emergency in South Africa. I thought it was here. But you normally associate puppets with children's entertainment. This is adult entertainment, although kids can certainly come see this show. But these puppets are amazing in that they are fully believable as characters and propel the story forward and enhance the story. As a puppeteer of long standing, and I have 10 seconds, Craig, this did not come as a surprise to you, I take it.
It came as a surprise to all of us, actually. You know, we opened the show in London, and none of us actually really knew how or what the audience's response would be.
Let me stop you there because I got to take a break. We'll come right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bylo Supermarkets, introducing Czech Soda with a variety of flavors, including orange pineapple, grape, strawberry, and premium draft root beer, available at Bylo. More information at buy-lo.com. And Heartwood Tree Service, spring is the dance that brings trees to life. Information about the health or safety of trees is available at Heartwood Tree Service, 704-525-3066 or at heartwoodtree.com. EU.com. Conflict in Syria. Lebanon is hit by deadly rocket fire. The EU ends its ban on arms to rebels. And Senator John McCain makes a surprise visit there. You can join the conversation about all of that and more in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. And when we come back, more about War Horse. Stay with us.
I'm Marco Werman. No one brings you world news like PRI's The World. Our reporters have one mission, to bring you a coherent picture of your day around the globe, to connect your world with what's happening beyond our borders. Join us weekday afternoons at 3 on WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about War Horse, which opened last night and plays through Sunday at the Belk Theater, blumenthalarts.org for tickets. Christopher Mai, Harlan Bengel, and Robert LaKey are several of the people who are the puppeteers who operate Joey, the principal character in War Horse. And also joining us by phone from South Africa is Craig Leo, who's associate puppet director with Handspring Puppet Company. They are the organization that created these puppets for this worldwide phenomenon called War Horse. The three of you in the studio here who operate, and you, I know you only do three shows a week, each of you, as the horse. I was told last night that that's not true, but that's okay. Mm-hmm. That you're not in the horse every night because it's heavy and it's hard and you're actually carrying people on the horse's back. And what's your experience prior to this? You are actors and dancers and not necessarily puppeteers. Is that right?
Well, what's great with our team specifically is that we've all come from a dance background.
Okay.
So, I mean, Harlan, Rob, and myself, we've all come from dance company work in New York City. So we start off with that type of vocabulary to talk to each other. But all the other puppeteers in the company have either been commedia dell'arte actors, musical theater performers, all types of the entire spectrum of performance artists.
And each of you controls a different part of this enormous horse. It's bigger than a horse really is. It's at least it appears to be bigger than a horse really is.
It's about the same size. It might be a hand or two larger in order to accommodate the puppeteers that have to work inside it and outside it. But it's about the right size.
And you're in the front end of the horse.
That's correct. I'm in the heart.
Okay, and that's why they call it heart, hind, and head.
Yes.
You control
the head.
The head, and you're actually visible because the head, which is really very interesting because you, I hate to say this to an actor, but you kind of disappear.
Oh yeah, if we disappear, we're doing our job right. Yeah.
I mean, even though you are fully visible, how difficult was it for you to learn how to make the movements so realistic? It's a horse. I mean, you believe it's a horse like that.
I think one of the best things, at least from the initial process of even going in for the auditions, is that even up close, that still reads, which is a credit sort of to the puppet itself, to Handspring and sort of the ability to be able to operate these. They're really works of art. They're sculptures.
Yeah.
And that's how I think of them. And they kind of have a life of their own. And so I think with any kind of puppetry, at least the way I think of it, is that we sort of are just helping that life come out. We're interpreters for the puppet itself. And it's a process that's still ongoing. It's nothing that we're like, nailed it. I'm a horse now. Sweet. it's something that we continually are trying to perfect. And like any art, you're never going to reach the perfection state.
I was going to ask about this because the horses, and there's more than one, mm-hmm. are so nuanced that you can't be completely choreographed. There are things that happen every night that maybe didn't happen last night that won't happen tomorrow night.
Yeah, for sure.
How do you – and it has to be coordinated. I mean, if the horse does something on the front end, he may have to have a corresponding movement in the back. So how do you coordinate that amongst yourself? You can't communicate.
We do. I mean, I think that's why our background sort of as dancers helps, because in dance, it's a nonverbal communication if you work with a partner as well. The challenge with this specifically is that you're three people and you're strapped to one object and one puppet, one work of art. But there are ways, and we know each other sort of intimately. It's like this strange kind of marriage in a sense, where if something Chris does, and I know his patterns and I know his, how he operates as well as a performer, that can be read all the way through the entire puppet. And like, even if he makes a certain kind of, and we make the sounds, we make the horse sounds ourselves. We're all mic'd.
Which are remarkable.
And that's, again, that's also a process I'm trying to perfect, because sometimes you'll make a sound and you'll literally be like, what was that?
That's odd. Craig, talk to me about how you designed these horses, because the Joey, who's the principal character, and there's another a secondary lead horse,
Tom Thorne.
Yeah, Tom Thorne, and then there are other horses that are part of this World War One cavalry, and that do charges on the stage, and it's just remarkable. But how did you design this creature?
Mike, I have to be honest, I'm not the designer. Okay. Basil and Adrian from Handspring are the actual makers and designers. I am a member and a performer with Handspring, but I can kind of give you an inkling into it. When we did the other production, Tall Horse, which is about the giraffe, they started to develop a system and a puppet made from cane. Which was the giraffe. And in that case, it was also life-size. It was 5 meters high, and we had two of the performers working inside the puppet with a leg strapped to their legs, but on stilts.
Mm.
And they carried this aesthetic through into the horses. And the big question was, of course, at one point, was, are we going to be able to carry the weight of a rider on our back? And we have some crazy pictures of us in the Handspring workshop with ladders and with two of us sticking heads through ladders, one on the one end and one at the other end, and then with somebody sitting on the bit in the middle, just to see if it was possible to actually take the weight. And it was. So from there, they then began to develop and make the horses into what you see today.
What's it like, gentlemen, to be inside the horse and have somebody riding as you're galloping across the stage?
Well, first of all, it's an incredible feeling to be inside the horse when one of our fellow actors is about to jump on top, and you sort of brace yourself, and then they get up there, and the next thing you know, you're going, and the horse is galloping, and the music is playing, and you can almost forget really what's going on, because you do get so involved in the action that you just feel the gallop, you feel what we call the surge, which is the three of us moving in unison in this gallop, and it becomes this whole other thing that you don't even feel the weight for those few moments.
I mean, we're concentrating on the puppets because that is a remarkable thing, and you're our guest, but the whole show is remarkable. It is beautifully staged, stunningly staged. Right down to where people are on the stage and how they get from one place to another. It's just stunningly staged. And then you have the sound effects, and you have the music, and you have the lighting, which is spectacular. And it's just, what's it like to be part of a production like that?
It's humbling. It's honoring. It's amazing. I mean, every start of the show, no matter if I'm a bird that flies across or part of the village, I keep looking as the lights come up on our first puppet. It's remarkable. The music, the birds chirping, it really is astonishing what type of theatrical magic that we're able to bring to audiences across the country right now.
It is magic. It's unlike anything I think I've ever seen, or certainly it's unlike anything I've seen since Nicholas Nickleby, which was an 8-hour play in New York. Which was also spectacular, and also from Britain. They know how to do theater.
Oh, yeah.
In Great Britain. But this is just unlike anything anybody's seen in this town, I'm sure. And they'll never see anything like it again, which is why they should rush for the few remaining seats that are available.
It's great. I mean, yeah.
You know, it's one thing for Steven Spielberg to do a cavalry charge in War Horse the movie. It's another thing to do it on a stage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the way they've put it together, the way that we're able to tell that story on a stage in such a confined space without giving stuff away to the audience that hasn't seen it yet, with some visuals, some sound effects and things like that. And the horses, It's not every day you get to be a part of something that you can be as proud of as I think we all are, I can say safely, of this show. Let's face it, as an actor, as a dancer, sometimes it's work.
Yep.
And you do what you got to do for that paycheck. But this is a show I can honestly say that I'm extremely proud of.
And I think that's realized in, amongst the cast, and that's why I think it feels like a true ensemble.
Yeah.
With people from, you know, varying levels of experience are, you know, with this production right now. And I think there is a sense of this is unique. This is something that is special, that's going to be very
Definitely.
Special in our careers and in our lives. Yeah. And I think we all appreciate it, which makes the work even better.
It's nice because it's more of like an inviting show. And how it's so universal for all audiences is that, you know, we invite our audiences to participate in the imagination game with us, you know? So, I mean, everything's suggested. So costumes are suggestive of a time frame. The props that some people are holding, it's a basic pole, but you're engaging your own imagination to take that ride and that journey with us. So that's why it's so, it's marketable for all ages, parents and children.
Craig, did the folks at Handspring Puppets take an active involvement in helping new people, newcomers to the show? Because there are companies all over the world. Help them to understand how to manipulate these puppets and make them so real?
They do as best they can. It's quite a grueling rehearsal process. I'm sure the chaps will agree with that. Sometimes, very often, what will happen is because the show has been going on every year, and one has been opening quite regularly, almost every year and a half, we are now at a stage where we have the associate directors, that's myself, and then there's Finn Caldwell, and then Mervyn Miller. Mervyn's doing Berlin at the moment. Finn did Australia with me, and I'm going to be doing the UK tour. And, for example, the UK tour and Berlin are happening at the same time. So, you know, what's happening now is the original cast members who have been with the show all along are now taking over and teaching and passing on information. And one of the gentlemen also said something which I think is very true, is that this particular production is very special, so much so that it's one of those experiences that you will take with you probably for the rest of your life. You know, it changes you, and it changes the world that you work and practice in. And that is one of the best and most wonderful gifts that Warhorse actually gives us as performers.
I know that the creators of these puppets that you referenced a few minutes ago, Craig, studied equine anatomy before they built the first Joy. But it's not just the anatomy of the horse, although you've got the horse. The horses look so real, even though they're framework and fabric and metal and plastic and whatever else. But it's more than anatomy. It's understanding how a horse moves, how it moves its ears, how it canters, how it gallops, how it trots, how it stands still.
You put your finger on it right there. Is that the Handspring Puppet Company was people like Merv and people like that were so instrumental in reminding us that the stillness of the puppet, the stillness of a horse when you just see him in the field, is what's so majestic. And then his ability to burst forward and run and charge and stop on a dime is what makes you watch an animal like a horse and think, wow, this is amazing. So for us, a lot of it is being able to take in that stillness. To find the breath of the horse is extremely important. If you haven't seen it,
yes.
Yeah.
When the horse is breathing,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
It is remarkable.
Yeah.
that's you?
That's I lead that, yes. The heart puppeteer leads that, and I'm happy to say I get to lead that. So that stillness, and you can just see the horse breathing, you can feel it breathing, and then suddenly we're going. Suddenly someone's jumping on the back. Suddenly we're running around the stage. And I think the stillness and the breath really brings power to this massive animal. Mm. And then the movement that follows is just wow.
Yeah. Now, you're the head.
I'm the heart.
You're the heart. Excuse me, the heart. Harlan's the heart. I'll get it right.
That's all right.
But Rob, you're the hind.
I am indeed.
We know what that means without becoming too graphic. So I have to ask, can you see where you're going?
I actually can because the skin of the horse is a mesh material. Mm-hmm. I can't see directly in front of me. I see Harlan's head. But I do get a really good sort of peripheral view out of the flanks of the horse. And also, if Chris, if he operates the head, you know, outside of center, I can also see the head. So, and I have the luxury to be able to, you know, turn my head all the way around and sort of look where I'm going and look and see what I'm doing.
So in these movement sequences where you, it has to be choreographed, you can't,
there is
you have
staging
to be at the right place.
Yeah,
at the
I
right
mean,
time.
Just for safety concerns, we kind of get a directive that there is this present quality of animals that's unpredictable. And so we get that, we are given that directive to be able to have a certain amount of freedom to, if an actor gives you a certain amount of energy, then we can respond in kind with a different kind of energy that's different from the show before, the show before, the show before. We do have staging and blocking and choreography that we must accomplish, right. Otherwise it would be chaos.
So you would describe the galloping and the cavalry charge and things like that as being choreographed.
That is definitely staged because we're in such close quarters with other actors on top of us and next to us that if we decided that we're not going to run, I think it would
and be
interesting, but it would be kind of bad.
And there's a lot of people in the show. There's like 30 people in the mm-hmm. cast, and mm-hmm. they're all many times on stage with you at the same time, and a tank.
Oh, yeah.
And other animals and bombs going off. For people who only go to see musicals when they come to town,
our play has music as well.
Exactly. But let me just say that this is every bit as spectacular and show-stopping.
It's a full realized production.
As a musical. And it will be the most spectacular play you will probably ever see in your life.
Thank you.
Here's hoping.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's really great. I mean, I forget that it's just it's categorized as a play because of the theatricality of it. The puppets itself, I mean, it's shocking to see all of this come to fruition on stage, you know. And it's really great. It gets at the heartstrings of everyone in the audience, and just the tale of the friendship between a boy and his horse is really, really great to see.
You've captured it. That's Christopher Mai, who's the head of the horse. Harlan Bengel is the heart. Robert Lackey is the hind. We won't hold that against you. And Craig Leo joined us from South Africa, associate puppet director with Handspring Company, a puppet company, the people who created these remarkable animals, puppets, in War Horse, which plays through Sunday at the Belk Theater, BlumenthalArts.org, or 704-372-1000. Thanks for the hour.